This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
Cary Grantham's son, James, started his first year of secondary school in the middle of the COVID pandemic. And initially, everything seemed to be going just fine. The young teenager had friends, he was outgoing, and he was doing well academically. But shortly after the Christmas break in first year, something changed.
He arrived at school in January and he had a panic attack in the car park. And that was the first sign and that was the last sign, because he never was able to get back into school without very severe fear. He would say to me that he knew that if he got out of the car, something really bad was going to happen, even though his rational mind knew that he was safe.
3 years on from that first panic attack in the car, Kerry says her son has never been able to return to his old school.
A switch went off, and sounds crazy, but I was at pains to tell all the professionals I reached out to that a switch had gone off and that he was no longer the same child.
James's story is perhaps on the extreme end of why some children become absent from school. And we'll hear more about his story later. But there's a whole host of reasons why a child may try to avoid the classroom. What is certain is that school absenteeism is on the rise. Figures from TUSLA report that unexplained school absences have quadrupled in just 3 years. So what's to blame? Social media or rising rates of anxiety? And how much did the pandemic and protracted lockdowns affect attitudes around school attendance?
You know, some would point to really what is maybe a fundamental shift that's happened around the culture of school, and that may be long-lasting or maybe it's short-term, it remains to be seen, but really school attendance became kind of optional, you know, in a sense, during the pandemic period, because the habit of daily school attendance was severed when the schools shut in March 2020.
This is In the News from the Irish Times. I'm Saoirse Pollock. Today, what is behind the rise in school phobia and school avoidance? Kerry, your son James, and I'll note that that's not his real name. We've changed his name to protect his privacy. He's in his mid-teens now, but due to severe anxiety, he's been out of school for around 2 years. You want to stress, Kerry, that this is not school refusal, because in James's case, he physically can't go to school, even if he wanted to, that the anxiety and the terror have just taken over.
It is incredible to witness a child who wanted more than anything to get into school. Like, he wanted school, he wanted his life back, and we were unable to give him any answers. So every night he would set himself up ready to get back to school. He'd be excited. You know, there was no visible signs that he would be unable to get back into school, because that's what every kid does. They just go into school every day, and we took that for granted. But there was something within his brain that stopped him, because every time we got close to the school premises, he would go into the most horrendous panic. Like, he and really the best way I can describe it is he was fighting for his life, and he thought if he got out of the car, he was going to die. No matter, you know, there was no reasoning with him when he got into that state, because he was in such a fight or flight state. So there was no choice in the matter. There was no deep breathing that would get him in. It was pure fight or flight. And so we would be left with no choice but to just pull away from the building. And sometimes it would take hours for him to come back round. Sometimes he would have pulled back by the top of the road and he'd ask to go again. And the exact same thing would happen again. And he was so scared, because he was like, what is happening to me? And there was no answers. Leading up to that, there was no signs of anxiety. There was no sign whatsoever. He had, you know, normal experience in primary school. He had lots of friends. He academically, he was doing really good. So the first sign was that second term in secondary school.
James was in his final years of primary school when the pandemic hit. How much do you think, Kerry, the lockdowns contributed to his school phobia?
As his mother, I would say I'm certain the pandemic contributed to it, because that was fifth and sixth class of the lockdowns of the schools. James would, he would complete his schoolwork, but he retreated quite gradually. He retreated and wouldn't reach out to friends or wouldn't call them back. So I could see that he was quite happy in the environment of being at home. But having said that, he went back to school quite happily after both lockdowns. But the problem was that he graduated then in primary school in sixth class, and there was no great parties or no great farewells because nobody was allowed within an inch of the school. And then when he went into the secondary school, he'd never seen inside the building. And when they started in secondary school, they had all had masks, and he was in a pod of, say, six. So actually, I'm shocked that he managed so well, because he didn't see the faces of his peers, you know, 90% of the school day. And then he wasn't really encouraged to talk to anybody outside his six. So I'm certain it contributed it to it. But he did really enjoy that first term. He joined in loads of clubs and sports and made loads of friends. And so when that first panic attack came in January, there wasn't many warning signs at all. Like, there was no reluctance to go to school building up to that. I don't think he even knew it was coming. I really don't. A switch went off, and sounds crazy, but I was at pains to tell all the professionals I reached out to that a switch had gone off and that he was no longer the same child.
When it became clear to you that going to school wasn't a realistic option for James, where did you turn to, and what options were available?
So there was never the option of him not going to school, if I'm totally honest with you, because every corner I turned would give me different advice. They would tell me to tell him to rest at home for 3 weeks, to recover, to try again. We were advised to not make home fun, to take away all the devices and keep to a timetable at home. That didn't work. We were advised to put him on medication. That didn't work. So nobody ever said, here's an alternative. There was no alternative, because he was under 16. So there's no services. So he was engaged with CAMHS. He would go to CAMHS every week. So our turning point came 2 years into the journey. I had stopped working at the time, and my family was being ripped apart, because it all became about getting James into school. And none of the three of us mattered, because we were so focused on just getting him into school and getting him to overcome this, as if James had a choice. It just blows my mind now, looking back. But it came to a point where his mental health got so bad, and my mental health got so bad, and my daughter was suffering, and my husband was suffering. And it pains me to say this, but education just became not the most important thing, because I knew if we continued on this journey, something was going to break. So as parents, we had to make a massive decision to stop forcing him to try get into school.
So what is the situation now? How is he doing, and what kind of access to educational opportunities does he have?
So in the end, we were informed of a service called iSchool, which is a charity-based organisation that offers online learning for age 13 to 15. So it was very hard to get information about, and the only way of getting on a programme is referral from your local educational welfare officer. So we obviously worked with the educational welfare officer in trying to get James back into school. So we had her support and she was able to submit a referral form for James. But the problem with the iSchool programme is that they only have funding for a certain amount of places. And obviously there is a huge amount of children in the same boat as James. So James was actually turned down the first time we applied. And I will be completely honest with you, it was the end for all of us, because I knew that was the only hope of giving James back a future and a purpose and a reason to get up every morning. So we did end up getting a place when I reappealed. So James has been on that program for 3 months and he has his light back in his eyes. He's getting up every day to an individualized lesson plan. He engages with his tutors online. He has a weekly video call with his mentor and he is achieving a level 3 qualification out of school.
Kerry, have you met other parents going through a similar situation, and how widespread do you understand this issue to be? Because I know your story was recently featured in an article in the Irish Times. So have you heard from other parents as a result of that piece?
In the beginning, no, it was very hard to find people because I think it's such a private thing to go through as a family, and there is an element of shame attached to it because you on the surface look like you've lost control of your child, because every child has to go to school, right? I was really lucky. I met a mother and son in the same school as we were going to, and we connected with them, and the two boys have been on the same journey. So they have been a life-saving, you know, opportunity for us. Since I wrote the article, I am shocked at how many 13 to 15 year olds are sitting in their rooms every day. It has broken my heart to read some of the stories, because they shouldn't be left in their rooms. They can't be left in their rooms. Developmentally, psychologically, iSchool is the only organisation that I came upon that offered a service for the under 16 age group. Ideally, in an ideal world, all the children that parents wrote to me about their children, ideally, they should all be offered a place, but they can't be because of funding. It's really important that these children are not left in their rooms feeling like they failed every day. Every person in the world needs a reason to get up every day, and that's a human right. Education is a human right. For the children who can't, not won't, for the children who can't get into school, for the under 16s, there's no alternative.
Kerry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, education editor Carl O'Brien explores the other factors at play in school avoidance.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
Carl O'Brien is the Irish Times education editor. Carl, we've just heard from Kerry there, who was speaking about her son James's experience with school phobia. And while their story might be on the extreme end of the scale, and perhaps not the most common reason for absenteeism, we know that anxiety does play a role in all of this. So maybe you can begin by telling us about these terms, school phobia and school refusal. What other forms can they take, and how widespread is this problem?
In simple terms, it involves a student who refuses to attend a school or feels that they can't go to school because they're experiencing distress. Now, school refusal differs from truancy or mitching, in that the young person is at home with the knowledge of the family, who generally, you know, despite their efforts to enforce or encourage them to go to school, the fact they are still at home. Now, psychologists will say the school refusal, it's generally a symptom of something else. There can be mental health problems, anxiety, depression, learning difficulties, social rejection, bullying, you know, lots of potential issues there. But for the children themselves, they are typically avoiding school because they're trying to escape negative feelings. So that can be anxiety, worries about the social interactions, whatever those issues are. In terms of the scale of it, there aren't reliable figures collated by school authorities, but there are a number of red flags that are being raised in different areas. And certainly signs are that school avoidance is on the increase, and it's been exacerbated by the pandemic and school closures. So if you take a look at anxiety rates and depression rates, they've doubled. Demand for assistance from the HSE Child and Adolescent Services has gone through the roof. TUSLA, which records the Child and Family Service, which records school attendance, has recorded a dramatic increase in chronic absenteeism, but it doesn't break that down into school refusal. And a last indicator is the National Educational and Psychological Service. So they provide support to schools, and they have documented a marked increase in pupils exhibiting what they would term a school refusal in the last 2 to 3 years.
Carl, principals are reporting that school refusal has become a real issue since the pandemic. Do we know a little bit more about why that is and what changed during COVID that prompted children to want to stay home more?
You're right. It was certainly an issue prior to the pandemic, but there's no doubt, certainly talking to school principals and counsellors, that this is an issue that's been exacerbated by the pandemic. And, some would point to really what is maybe a fundamental shift that's happened around the culture of school, and that may be long lasting, or maybe it's short term, it remains to be seen. But really, school attendance became kind of optional, in a sense, during the pandemic period, because the habit of daily school attendance was severed when the schools shut in March 2020. Then Ireland had one of the longest periods of school closures in Europe, certainly at primary level. And even when schools did reopen, things didn't snap back to normal. You still had ongoing disruption, high rates of absenteeism and sickness. And certainly principals will say that that has continued at a lower level, but still at a level that is markedly more increased than before the pandemic. And, one issue potentially is that there are still parents who are working from home, and students staying at home is more of an option, And so I guess in some ways, in the same way that work hasn't fully returned to normal yet, with workers typically in office jobs anyway, back maybe a few days a week, similarly for school, it hasn't fully returned to normal yet. And we're still living, I think, in the shadow of the pandemic in a lot of ways.
Carl, does the socioeconomic status or the geographic location play a role in whether a child is more likely to be absent from school or not?
When it comes to school anxiety and school refusal, most experts would tend to agree that this doesn't discriminate when it comes to where students are from, whether it's an affluent or deprived areas. But there's no doubt that school attendance generally is lower in areas of deprivation and social disadvantage. Now, of course, that was an area prior to the pandemic. Particularly, it is an issue now again. And you're seeing principals are particularly concerned about those students in that first year to third year area, So they're students who are probably most disrupted by the pandemic in a lot of ways, because they're at such a formative stage in their education. And for them, that idea of the school becoming almost optional has become perhaps more ingrained. And certainly school principals in a lot of disadvantaged or DESH schools say that they are struggling to get school attendance back to the levels that it was prior to the pandemic. So you are seeing, in fact, schools looking at trying to reward students and families for higher attendance rates. That kind of stuff really didn't tend to happen before the pandemic.
What about the impact on the kids themselves of missing so much school? I mean, there's obviously educational implications, but also there must be social implications too.
Absolutely. It has a huge impact on children. Socially, students are isolated. They're not mixing with their peers. They're not learning all of those skills those soft skills, as they're termed, in the schoolyard or in the classroom. They're retreating into themselves. Many might be really seeing their world shrink to their own digital device that they might use. Educationally, of course, it has an impact as well, because students aren't physically in the classroom, and they are missing out on that the personal tuition offered by tutors and teachers. The one thing is that, generally speaking, which was a bit of a surprise, is that the pandemic hasn't hit students generally as hard as many feared. And we're still trying to figure out why that is. But Ireland has fared better than a lot of countries. So the standards of education haven't been hit in the same way as they have been in the US, for example. And maybe one idea around that is the fact that schools pivoted quite quickly to try to support children who are at home. But the problem now is those students who are not attending school now after the pandemic, in most cases, do not have the option of remote tuition. They're just relying on notes and trying to catch up on what's happening in the class. And certainly, I think there's alarm in many families where this is an issue, that students are falling well behind where their peers are.
Carl, I want to ask briefly about the term anxiety. Now, clearly, there are young people suffering from legitimate anxiety, which requires support and treatment. But is anxiety perhaps becoming a catch-all term for any type of stress a young person might struggle with? And in turn, is this or could this be affecting young people's resilience and ability to deal with the stresses of exams, challenging social situations, which are all issues that they will continue to have to confront through into their adult lives?
It's a good question because, you know, a decade ago or maybe more, mental health issues were largely a taboo subject. You know, they weren't really discussed in any meaningful way in schools especially. But in the past decade, we've seen a huge emphasis on well-being and addressing issues like anxiety and depression and self-esteem and resilience. And, you know, there's two ways of looking at that. You know, one is that, you know, it's better than children can name that and that they can identify it in themselves and know where to turn to for support. But there's another school of thought that maybe this is doesn't necessarily help, you know, because students become maybe hyper aware of these issues and worry that they have a label of being anxious, and maybe that gives permission to a lot of associated behaviours. But there is no doubt, though, that there is a real issue here, and there's huge surveys have been carried out over this. There was a study done by the University of Galway with about 12,000 transition year students, and it found self-harm had increased, depression had increased markedly in recent years. So there's no doubt, you know, that something is going wrong for teenagers, and that is absolutely documented in academic terms as well.
Do we have any idea, Carl, what's causing these mental health issues among our young people? And it's important to ask, how much does access to smartphones almost constantly throughout the day play into all of this?
Yeah, many experts are pointing to the fact that these trends around the increase of anxiety and depression do mirror the growth of smartphone use and social media use. I suppose one of the leading proponents of the theory that, you know, always on access to social media is harming children's mental health is Jean Twenge, a professor of psychology in San Diego. Also her regular co-author, Jonathan Haidt. And they've pointed to changes in how teenagers are spending their time outside school starting from the 2010s onwards. And they've documented a downward slide in mental health, increased suicidal ideation and self-harm. And they are really looking at the fact that particularly social media is really driving social comparison and body image issues. And it's disrupting sleep patterns and it's prompting more cases of cyberbullying. So they would argue very strongly that this is something that's affected certainly US teenagers, and UK studies would reflect a lot of that as well. And certainly more recently in Ireland, we're seeing those patterns as well. Now, correlating it to social media or smartphone use is tricky, you know, and a lot of the reviews of this area would actually show that the links between social media use, smartphone use, and this decline in well-being is weak or inconclusive or indeed conflicting. But, you know, other experts are saying, well, what else is driving this? You know, like, is it just a reduction in stigma around mental health or greater awareness? Or is this huge rise must be linked to these changes in behaviour? And so it's an issue of kind of active debate, but there is no doubt, you know, that well-being is sliding and the sense of school connectedness is falling among young students. And that is absolutely a cause for alarm, I think, right across the education sector.
How are schools responding to this school phobia phenomenon? And is there a solution?
In short, schools are struggling. You know, the reality is that schools have very limited levers to pull because there aren't many options for schools. Now, some, in especially more disadvantaged schools, have what are called homeschool liaison officers. So their job is to keep that link between the family and the school. So that is one option. But many schools don't have access to that. And really, they don't really know where to turn when a student isn't in the school, because they're not in a position to provide remote teaching and there aren't many other options. So really, I think some of the more effective things that have worked for students are basically alternative forms of education. So you've places like the Cork Life Centre, where students who've fallen through the cracks are able to go into a much more of an informal school setting. So there are a few of those around the country. iSchool, which is remote teaching. And they are the kind of initiatives that do work well. You know, some school districts are providing other types of alternative education settings, but the reality is they are few and far between. And a lot of parents especially are tearing their hair out when it comes to trying to keep their kids connected to education.
Carl O'Brien, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That's all for today. For more education reporting from Carl O'Brien, subscribe at irishtimes.com/subscribe. I'm Saoirse Pollock. Today's episode was produced by Suzanne Brennan. In the News, we'll be back tomorrow.